Good morning, Alaska, and welcome to Line One, your health connection on Alaska Public Media. I am your host, Prentice Pemberton. A new report by the U.S. Surgeon General claims that loneliness and isolation have reached epidemic levels and that they are having a major impact on the health of our society. Human beings are hardwired for social connection, and the sense of belonging that comes with these connections is a vital component to our physical and mental health. The report states that people who lack these vital social connections increase the risk of premature death at a level that is equivalent to smoking 15 cigarettes a day. On today's edition of Line One, Dr. Nicole Argo is joining us to discuss the importance of belonging on the health of individuals and on our society as a whole. Welcome to the program, Dr. Argo. Thanks for taking the time to join us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
I am getting the pronunciation of your name correctly, right?
Perfect.
All right. It looks fairly simple, but you never know. I want to take a second to remind people that we value listener participation. If you have a question for my guest or a comment about today's topic, there are three ways to connect with us. If you are in the Anchorage area, our phone number is 907-550-8433. And if you're listening outside of Anchorage, you can reach us toll-free at 1-888-353-5752. And the last way to join us is to email your questions to line1@alaskapublic.org. You got to spell out line one, L-I-N-E-O-N-E. We will do our best to get your questions on the air. All right, Dr. Argo, let's start off. You have quite a list of credentials, which I didn't read, including Stanford and MIT. Those are decent schools. So can you give us a little bit more about yourself, your background, and what you're doing with the Over Zero Project?
Sure. So we're called Over Zero, and I'm the Director of Research and Field Advancement. My background is as a social psychologist who spent a lot of years studying social identity and intergroup dynamics. And what I mean by that is, our social identities, they influence how we think as individuals, how we think and act when we are in groups, and then how groups perceive and respond to one another, especially in times of conflict or uncertainty. So in all of my work, I've been really practitioner focused. I've worked with a lot of nonprofits here and abroad, and I've done a lot of field work with people on the ground in other countries. At Over Zero, my focus is on how social science can be used to make positive change in the real world. And that's actually what brought me here. So Over Zero is a nonprofit that leverages insights from both research and practice to better understand and counteract communication that drives individuals and societies towards division. I know that's a mouthful.
Right.
But we work with leaders, it could be faith groups, organizations, cities or states, to build resilience to identity-based violence. And we do that through trainings, coaching and advising, leadership development programs, or research. And the Belonging Barometer is one of those pieces of research.
So it's focused on more of the macro view of conflict and how we can improve like systems to reduce conflict. Am I understanding it correctly?
We might write sometimes about systems and their role, but the truth is we focus a lot more on leaders and individuals. And like, so if you're going to design a program,
right,
you know, what are some key considerations for building connections across difference or for communicating around difficult issues or even around, you know, those positive shared values that bring people together? So a lot of times our focus is on communication because it can be leveraged either to create an us and them mm-hmm. and further division, or to draw a bigger we and to like point us towards a North Star of cooperation or inclusion or other things. So we really try to focus on things that individuals, specifically leaders, organizations, or communities can do.
All right. Well, that's it seems like really relevant work today when we are so divided politically and on all these sort of cultural issues and identity and then the othering of people you mentioned. I like the making a bigger we as a way of looking at it. All right. So how are you? I mean, the Center for Inclusion and Belonging is helping sort of is partnering with you on some of this work. Can you talk about that partnership and what you're doing with them?
So the Center for Inclusion and Belonging is at the American Immigration Council, and we began working with them several years ago, originally to co-create trainings that they could use with their leaders and their cohorts of organizations across the country. These were communities that were seeking to build belonging and inclusion. And that work led us to start thinking about measurement. So how do we measure the really important impacts that these community-based organizations were having, and especially the less measured outcomes, like things like belonging, right? So everybody always says, how many people come to an event? You know, did they learn something, or did anything new start from this program? But also just like, were people taking something away that stayed with them for a long time after? And if so, what was it? Was it a change in how they perceived others? Was it their own sense of belonging? Was it the fact that they now knew people who were different from them and they didn't before, that they had new goals? So we spent a lot of time together thinking about, you know, what kinds of measures could groups do that would be easy to do and that could teach them something about how to get better and what people were walking away with.
Okay, now research is generally funded in order to like, because it's going to like create a benefit or you got to measure something. And why is it important? You developed this belonging barometer. Maybe we'll skip to that and have you kind of talk about what the belonging barometer, what that measures, and why is it important to measure belonging as far, I assume it's funding and social programs and things like that. But can you talk a little bit about why you developed this and why it's important?
Yeah. So you're right that whenever, you know, if people give a grant to a community or an organization, or even if, you know, the CEO decides to fund new programs at a workplace, wherever it's coming, people want to know what impact they're making. And so one answer to your question is that by measuring, you're able to show an impact. And specifically in terms of belonging, now that we're able to make a case that this affects so many critical aspects of life, it now is an important measure. So this is an impact we all want to make, and we can all agree that we want to make. So there's that piece of it. But the other, I think, even more important reason, having finished the belonging barometer and having worked with these organizations, is that, you know, sometimes you don't know where you stand, right? Like, imagine you're a local community or an organization and you do this work all the time. You know some of the people, you hear their thoughts, you've seen changes in how people behave, but you don't know everybody you've influenced. It's really hard to get feedback from all people, or that all people would feel comfortable enough sharing with you. It's hard to know, is everyone equally empowered? Did everyone come the same number of times? Like, just, I guess, the sense of being able to diagnose for the group you're working with, what do they need, right? Like, do they already feel belonging in that setting or not? And if they do in some ways, in what ways is that? And are there other ways that they don't? And then how do you design a program and measure its impact based on what you've learned about that community? Because we all know cookie cutter programs, they don't work, right? Like, whatever we're doing, it has to be completely tied into the community that we're in.
Yeah, and we can throw a lot of money at things and not have any real way to measure its success. So that's where you come in.
Absolutely. That's where we really hope to come in for anybody who considers belonging important.
All right. For those of you who might be tuning in late, Dr. Nicole Argo is joining us to discuss the importance of belonging on individual and societal health. If you have a question for Dr. Argo or a comment about today's topic, you can reach us in three ways. Our Anchorage number is 907-550-8433. You can call us toll-free outside of Anchorage at 1-888-353-5752. And the last way to get your questions on the air is to email us at line1@alaskapublic.org. All right, Dr. Argo, like when I see the word belonging, I think just of connection. But in reading the material that you sent out and doing some research on that, I think it's kind of, it's more nuanced than that. And I'd like for you to have an opportunity to kind of define what is belonging mean to you when you say the word belonging, and what are we measuring, what are we looking for, and like what are the components that really would give a person a sense of that belonging as you're sort of using it?
Yeah, absolutely. And I can honestly say that the way I think of it now has transformed because of this research. But you know, way back in the graduate school days as a social psychologist, one of the first things that you learn is that people need to belong, right? And some authors, some scholars have said it's as important, it's on par with the need for water and oxygen. There's an agreement that it's belonging is a primal motivational drive to form and maintain positive emotional bonds wherever you are. And it's wired into us. So you can imagine if you were cast out of your clan way back in the caveman days, you would be significantly less likely to survive, say if it was a tiger coming by or if it was winter. We have a need to belong, and it's as important as our need for love. This is a recent finding. And it's so great that it permeates our thoughts and our feelings and our behaviors even when we don't know it. Right? That we're always, the thoughts that we're taking from a setting and the things that we're thinking and even the goals we make are completely tied to how we feel within that setting. So belonging, or the lack of it, is tied to how we perceive and pursue our life goals. There's nothing that we're going to say or do that isn't influenced by it. So that's what I knew in grad school. But I think back then, I probably still would have thought of it as social connection. And a couple things came from this research. One is we have some amazing researchers working on belonging these days. And we took our definition from Greg Walton and Shannon Brady at Stanford. They talk about belonging as fit. It's a fit between a person and a setting. And the setting could be your family, your friends, it could be a place like the Grand Canyon or your backyard, it could be your workplace, a sports team, a local Y, your local community, you know, you name it. But the important thing about this fit is that it's dynamic. It is always changing for each of us. So for you or for me, we have a near constant, if implicit, we may not be aware of it always, but we're always assessing our fit in that environment. And that assessment is informed not just by our relationships in that setting, because I could imagine I could have great relationships at my school, but still feel marginalized, right? Mm-hmm. Or if I'm in a geographic space like the Grand Canyon, there's not even, relationships aren't a part of it. So there's a lot of things that go into our assessment, but the point is, we're using them to understand if and how we can fit or we will fit. And a second point here is that we may not even want to fit. I may not care if I fit in at Wall Street, right? Or if I'm not accepted or I don't belong on the cat enthusiast page, if pretending I had a dog. So our need for belonging is really only salient in the spaces where we want to belong.
Right.
And then the other piece is just that, because we do have multiple settings in our life where we are looking to fit. If I lack belonging in one space, I might look for it more in another, right? And that becomes really important sometimes as we think about like gaps between the places where we belong and how we're moving through our worlds. So So one of the big findings was fit. And then the other big piece of our work is the measure we created. So we are defining belonging as multifaceted. And we reviewed a bunch of literatures and we brought on some academic reviewers to help us craft this measure. And what we learned is that social connectivity is part of belonging. We talk about items like feeling emotionally attached or welcomed and included, or being satisfied by our relationships. But while belonging includes that, it's actually more than that. So belonging means feeling able to share our opinions in a group, even when they differ from others, without negative repercussions. This is called psychological safety.
Right.
I know I'm going on for a long time here and there's still more to say, but psychological safety has become a pretty popular term these days, especially in the business community, because we've realized that when people feel free and able to take risks, and to share new ideas, even if they may not be well received, it means that we're more innovative. We think outside the box and we do better. And this come from years of experimental studies, but most recently in 2015, Google did a massive, very well funded internal study of its best performing teams. And it found that psychological safety, teams where people felt like I can speak off the cuff, I don't have to prepare, I can disagree, it's all good, I'll still be valued, I'm still safe. Those teams were the top performers, and psychological safety beat out things like collective intelligence, the number of power players living in the same town or neighborhood. So, top performing teams have created a culture of psychological safety, and that's one part of belonging. And then finally, belonging also means having a sense of agency, or
Right.
co-creation is the word that we like to use. And that means that you know how a system or a group works, whether it's your family or your workplace, et cetera, and you feel treated equally to others, and you feel like you can influence decisions in that setting. So belonging is actually kind of a radical concept if you think about it. And it's truly multifaceted, but what we have found across literatures, although the measures often vary, is that when someone experiences these components of belonging, they thrive.
Right. It's interesting hearing you talk about that. All of the things that you mentioned brought me back to the word fit, right? And authenticity and people being able to be comfortable where they are with who they are and be themselves. And that comes from a f not feeling alienated, not feeling othered, really just feeling a part of, which is belonging.
Yeah, that's exactly right. That's exactly right.
All right. Can you, well, we got just a couple minutes here till our break, but can you talk briefly about the Surgeon General's report on lonely and isolation and the idea that it's an epidemic?
Yep, absolutely. So the US Surgeon General Vivek Murthy came out with a book, I think it was back in 2020, that really introduced this idea beautifully. It was called Together. And then more recently, just last week, in fact, this advisory has come out from the Surgeon General's office, citing an epidemic of loneliness in the United States and noting that lacking these important social connections can increase the risk for premature death to levels that compare to smoking 15 cigarettes a day, as you said at the beginning of this session. And he talks about the fact that it's not just because of COVID. It finds that even before the COVID-19 pandemic, almost half of US adults reported measurable levels of loneliness. Like belonging, measures for loneliness, they differ, right? But
Right.
whenever you use one measure over time, we're able to see these declines. So some of their studies have linked the physical consequences of poor connection to a 29% increased risk of heart disease, a 32% increased risk of stroke, a 50% increased risk of dementia for older adults, and many, many more things. So the Surgeon General's advisory is really, it's intending or hoping that it can increase the call for our nation and our communities to strengthen our social fabric, to really reach out and connect, to recognize that this is something we need, and to really prioritize meaningful relationships in our work and in our daily lives.
Yeah, and in my line of work as a therapist, I see loneliness and isolation as huge contributors to depression, anxiety, addiction, all of those sorts of mental health things that are really alleviated by connection and fit and a sense of belonging and community. Let's we're up against our first break. So for those of you who might be tuning in late, Dr. Nicole Argo is our guest. Today, we are discussing the importance of belonging on our physical and emotional health and taking a look at the consequences of loneliness and isolation in our communities. If you have a question for Dr. Argo or comment about today's topic, you can reach us in three ways. In Anchorage, our local number is 907-550-8433. Outside of Anchorage, you can reach us toll-free at 1-888-353-5752. And our email is line1@alaskapublic.org. After a short break, we'll return for more of our conversation with Dr. Nicole Argo. I'm Prentice Pemberton. You're listening to Line One, Your Health Connection on Alaska Public Media.
You're listening to Line One from Alaska Public Media. You can find Line One on alaskapublic.org or wherever you get your podcasts.
If you've got Medicaid, make sure Medicaid has got you too by keeping your contact information up to date. Visit MedicaidRenewals.alaska.gov to use the new online form to quickly update your contact information without waiting. A current mailing address, phone number, and email address is needed to avoid delays in healthcare coverage. Plan to stay covered by visiting MedicaidRenewals.alaska.gov for information and resources. This message sponsored by the Alaska Department of Health.
Welcome back to Line One, Your Health Connection on Alaska Public Media. I am your host, Prentice Pemberton. If you are just tuning in today, Dr. Nicole Argo is our guest, and we are discussing the impacts of loneliness and isolation on society and looking at the importance of belonging to our physical and emotional health. If you have a question for Dr. Argo or a comment about today's topic, you can reach us in three ways. Our Anchorage number, that's if you're living locally, is 907-550-8433. Outside of Anchorage, you can reach us toll-free at 1-888-353-5752. And the last way to get your questions on the air is to email us at line1@alaskapublic.org. All right, before the break, we were talking about belonging and loneliness and isolation. And I really want to, like, you mentioned something earlier that a sense of belonging is as vital to human survival as, like, water and food. And obviously, it's not as critical in that it will kill you in, you know, days or weeks if you don't have it. But from an evolutionary perspective, it makes a lot of sense that this is a really primitive drive, like love, sex, food, water. And I'm sure in the research you've come across, like, why is that? I mean, it's obviously an adaptive thing for humans to be connected, and we are weak as a single animal. We don't do very well in isolation, and that's where addiction thrives is in isolation and a lack of connection. So can you talk about like what the research shows and why that's an adaptive thing for humans to come together?
Yeah, I think, I think everything you just said is right on, that when you're part of a community, you protect each other, right? That going back to the clan example in the winter, or if a tiger comes. But I think there's more than that, right? So when we have strong social connections, when we feel valued and needed, when we have a purpose, there's a, you know, oxytocin. Mm-hmm. You get an oxytocin hit with a hug or with the sense that that you're connected to someone. You have a homeostasis, in fact. Like when all is well with the self and its social setting, that's when we can focus on learning in school or building something at work. The brain, when it is not at ease about where we fit, it's got a lot going on, right? It's distracted. It's going to try to prove that someone fits in. Maybe they're going to take more risks or do more things. We've seen studies like that when groups are on the periphery of a social network, right? So they're uncertain about their belonging, or when individuals are, they're more willing to take risks to prove their loyalty or their worth to a group. So belonging is necessary for just kind of homeostasis and emotional well-being that allows us to do all the things that we need to do in life. And as you said, when we lack that, it's painful in its own way, right? This is social isolation. This is loneliness. You know, some studies have suggested, and since then, I feel like there's not really a consensus on this, but are we more attuned to the negative, to the risks, to the dangers? Are we more anxious? There have been mental health correlations. Certainly, you're aware of this literature. Performance in schools declines. Workplace performance declines, even for CEOs who are lonely and lacking social connection. So there are so many ways that the individual brain and the larger self experience dysfunction when we don't have that sense of belonging.
And it's important to think of it based on a need, not a want. And that comes from a real primitive part of our brain, right? It's a drive that is not conscious, although we think, oh, I feel lonely. But you can't will your way out of that. You can't just say, I'm not going to feel lonely, or I'm not going to feel disconnected. It is just it's a drive that comes up from our unconscious, and because it's a need, like thirst. You can't just say, well, I'm not thirsty.
Yeah, there's, I can't recall the author's name at the moment, but it's a brilliant article where he's arguing belonging is tied at its core to the most complex and fundamental social issues of today, right? And as you mentioned earlier, imagine somebody, when we lack belonging, we feel a force to go out and find it. So imagine that you lack belonging. It feels miserable. You're constantly questioning. You want the pain to go away. You want to find your fix. So this is tied in drug studies too, literally to like getting a hit from drugs, right?
Yeah.
When we lack, and I'm not saying that's always what leads to drugs. I'm not like, there's obviously many pathways, but the idea of when we lack belonging and we need it, we go out and find it somewhere else. And sometimes we do that in an unhealthy way. And that leads to societal problems as well. There are also ways to do it more healthily and build up the social support and systems that we need for belonging.
Yeah, I think about some studies. One's the Harvard study they did on happiness for 100 years and followed groups, and that happiness really doesn't have much to do with, you know, money above really the poverty line. And it has to do with relationships and connection. They didn't I don't remember it mentioning belonging, but that's all the stuff you're talking about, right? Is that?
Yeah, they didn't rigorously measure belonging, but I just remember somewhere in there was a line like, happiness is the number of shoes inside your front door.
Right.
And this idea of like the meaningful relationships in your life that give you joy and sustenance and, you know, and social support and all the things. And that's a beautiful study over so many years.
Yeah.
It's quite amazing. And I think the same thing as you're saying with income, I think they say more income does help a bit with happiness, up to 75,000, and then it plateaus.
Yeah.
Until like some millions, like, you know, for a really long period. So having enough to survive is important for people, but really it's about the meaningful relationships in our lives.
Right. Beyond meeting the basic needs and comforts of shelter and food and housing, right? I mean, that's beyond that, it doesn't have much a return on each dollar. It diminishes significantly. The other study that was really interesting was the, which I'm sure you're familiar with, the rats in isolation doing cocaine and or heroin to death 100% of the time. And then rats in a rat park, you still use some drugs, but they did not do it to death, which I found fascinating, that sense of connection. And I guess rats feel belonging too.
Absolutely. We all have. I mean, I'm not a rat expert.
Right.
But we are all, we share, I think, with much of the animal kingdom, this sense of belonging to a family or a group, right? And that's a survival mechanism. And when we're missing it, even if someone's giving us food, like something feels very wrong. And that's a difficult thing, discomforting thing to live with.
And there's lots of examples in the animal kingdom of groups. Elephants are a great example. You know, like that sense of community and family. All right, we do have a phone call. It's somebody, Kristen's been on hold in Anchor Point. You're on line one. Go ahead, Kristen.
Yes, I'm wondering about public programs for mental health, because even as things get worse and worse, the funding for people on limited incomes, like old people on Social Security, state aid, Medicare, Medicaid does not cover a lot of mental health problems. And then you have just regular people who can't really afford to go to psychiatrists and pay hundreds of dollars an hour to tell somebody, you know, to try to find out what is necessary to make their lives better. I mean, even as we become more and more aware of mental health problems in this country, more and more the finances of it, people who have to go to medical school to get a psychiatric degree, psychologists having to go to school and training to get their degree and certification, this all costs money. And their ability to access cheap money, you know, through student loans and Pell Grants and what have you, has pretty much dried up, so that even if you want to go into these fields, you have to come out, you know, running. You have to come out making that money right now, because you've
right.
got to pay back these loans. And that means people on limited incomes that cannot be subsidized, well, they're just going to be thrown by the wayside.
All right, Kristen, you got a bad connection. Your phone's popping a lot, but I think I get the gist of your question. And Dr. Argo, can you speak to that idea of how that ties in with belonging, the mental health care and the access that people have to quality health care and mental health care? And for those that don't have access to that, we see that all over the world, people that don't have access to the basic needs, and they don't have time to, as you mentioned earlier, focus on belonging. It's really about survival. And when you're in survival state, it's different than when you have that sense of homeostasis and comfort that you mentioned. So can you comment on Kristen's call?
Sure. I have a couple linkages, I think, to the work we've done with belonging. First being that in our study, belonging was linked both to general and mental health. And importantly, when we looked at factors related to belonging, and this gets to Kristen's point about socioeconomic status, that one of the most significant factors, the most significant factor in across all the life settings was feeling that you're worse off or much worse off than others in one's community socioeconomically. So it's not just that people can't access healthcare or insurance and the ability to get mental health care, but it's also in the terms of belonging, that people who are at the lower socioeconomic status are feeling less belonging in the country. And why do I think that's important? Because to me, it points to, you know, not just the fact that we need to fix the systems so that people can become aware and can get access to proper mental health care, but it's also, you know, at the local level, even at the individual, in our families, in our neighborhoods, we know that belonging is associated with mental health too. How do we create belonging in these places to lift up and to support people as much as we can? So I think there's that piece, just to state the obvious, but to your point about the systems, I'm not an expert, but the more research comes out around loneliness and belonging and, you know, adjacent concepts like the experience of discrimination or, you know, all of these social factors that influence mental and physical health, I think the more pressure and awareness it puts on our systems to do something.
Yeah, I mean, thinking about Kristen's call, I think it's a great call and it brings up a lot of good points. But I think that access to equal care and to like real, you know, care that looks at the whole person as, you know, as a human being and really takes into account their needs and wants. And it's hard to create societies that support that or facilitate that or give those opportunities for that sort of connection and belonging. And so we're going to talk a little bit about that after we come back from the break. But I have an email here that asked if you would please repeat the stats on the relationship between isolation and increased health risk, like heart attacks, stroke, dementia, et cetera. Can you talk just briefly about those again for our listener?
Sure. So this came from the Surgeon General's advisory. And I think the first thing I mentioned was that about half of US adults are experiencing loneliness. The physical consequences include a 29% increased risk of heart disease, a 32% increased risk of stroke, and a 50% increased risk of developing dementia in older adults.
And that goes along with the risks of addiction problems, substance abuse problems, domestic violence. I mean, we saw all of those things anecdotally, probably we saw all of those things increase during the pandemic when people were losing those connections and their sense of community. We had, you know, all the mental health facilities were full. We had teenagers, like Colorado went through a crisis. They didn't have enough beds for teenagers for their mental health units. It just seems to like blow up systemically.
Yeah, that's exactly right.
Okay. I do have a phone call, but I don't want to rush through that. So we're going to go ahead and take a break. If John, if you'll hang on for just another minute or so, we'll get you on the air right after we go to a break. So if you're just joining us, Dr. Nicole Argo has has joined us today to discuss the importance of belonging on our physical and emotional health and on the health of our society as a whole. After this short break, I'll let you know how you can reach us with your questions and comments, and we will continue with more of our conversation about belonging. I'm Prentice Pemberton, and you're listening to Line One, Your Health Connection on Alaska Public Media.
You're listening to Line One from Alaska Public Media. You can find Line One on alaskapublic.org or wherever you get your podcasts.
If you've got Medicaid, make sure Medicaid has got you too by keeping your contact information up to date. Visit medicaidrenewals.alaska.gov to use the new online form to quickly update your contact information without waiting. A current mailing address, phone number, and email address is needed to avoid delays in healthcare coverage. Plan to stay covered by visiting medicaidrenewals.alaska.gov for information and resources. This message sponsored by the Alaska Department of Health.
Welcome back to Line One, Your Health Connection on Alaska Public Media. I am your host, Prentice Pemberton. If you're just joining us, Dr. Nicole Argo is our guest, and we are discussing the importance of belonging on physical and emotional health and its impact on society as a whole. If you have a question for Dr. Argo or a comment about today's topic, you can reach us in three ways. In Anchorage, our phone number, local number, is 907-550-8433. Outside of Anchorage, you can reach us toll-free at 1-888-353-5752. And the last way to participate is by emailing your questions to line1@alaskapublic.org. Please don't wait until the last 5 minutes of the program to call in, because that happens a lot and we don't have time to get you on the air. All right, we're going to go to John in Anchorage. You have a question for Dr. Argo?
Yeah, this is a very interesting topic, by the way. I was curious, though, about how people select and prioritize their relationships through this kind of an interaction with people. And does it change as a function of age as well? Those are my main questions.
All right. Dr. Argo?
That's a wonderful question. So, the Surgeon General's report tracked people's social networks and social participation over decades. And your question about, like, do we change as individuals? Do we prioritize social relationships, for instance, more as we get older or more as we're young and we have more time? It's a very good question. I'm not expert, but what we are hearing or seeing or reporting is that on average, people years ago, well, let's say this. In 2021, almost half of Americans reported having three or fewer close friends. Only a quarter reported that same statistic in 1990. So your question is about individuals and change over time. And most of the research right now is looking at trends on average over time and saying that we're really spending far less time on our social relationships today than we were three decades ago, or four or five decades ago. And that our friendships are also fewer today than they were decades ago. We're also seeing that for younger people, the decline is the most stark. Mm-hmm. So your ages 15 to 24 today, the time you're spending in person with friends has reduced by nearly 70% over two decades. So this generation, this really young generation, is struggling very much. And we saw that in our belonging barometer as well, where the younger you are, it was a very significant finding, almost on par in terms of impact as socioeconomic status. So the younger you are, the less belonging you're reporting. And the older you were, surprisingly, the older you were, the more belonging people were reporting.
It does not seem like a coincidence that these numbers of, especially for young people, have plummeted in 20 years. That is the era of the cell phone and the iPad, and this lack of human interaction. I mean, when I see my dog on a video call with my kid and I say, hi, Tara, hi, she does not respond. If I see her in person, she wags and jumps all over the place, but she won't even look at the camera. And that connection, there is something about the human to human eye contact connection that is grossly missing in today's society. And I think young kids, that's what I'm seeing in my office, it really is having a huge impact on mental health, especially, and physical health. A lot more obesity, health problems, poor nutrition, goes on and on. So I think part of the caller's question was how to identify which relationships are good, because all of us, mm-hmm. I mean, there's a lot of people stuck in really toxic relationships where they don't feel that fit and that sense of safety. So how do you know?
Oh, goodness. Prentice, you should speak to this too, since you're a therapist. But, you know, it's funny, the social connection literature talks about the various things that matter for social connection. Is one is the number and variety of relationships, the structure. The other one is the degree to which those relationships serve needs for you, like emotional support or mentorship or support in a crisis. And then the other one is the quality, right? So the positive, negative aspects. And the question we use in the barometer to get at this is relationship satisfaction, I think. Mm-hmm. And then relationship strain is another part of that. But I think each and every one of us, you know, we can think through our close family and friends. And it's not so hard when you look at the last month or years of that relationship to say, like, in general, do I walk away feeling satisfied? Do I feel like heard and seen? Do I feel comfortable? You know, is this over time generally positive? All relationships go through things. But is over time, is it generally stressful or straining?
Right.
And are the dynamics lifting both people up in general or not? And again, over time and on average. But I think we do have an intuition about what's good for us in a lot of cases.
Yeah, that's instinctual, right? And I think it goes back to some of our primitive brain, and all the things you talk about are fit, right? In a relationship, it is, can I be myself? Can I speak my mind? That emotional safety that you talked about, I think is vital in identifying what relationships are healthy and which ones are toxic or take away from that sense of emotional safety. So I think that's a critical piece in looking at that. All right, we have another phone call. We'll just keep going with that. Lucy in Anchorage, you're on line one. Go ahead.
Hi. I am a newly retired nurse after 46 years, and I spent a large part of my last years doing some home health. And it was very interesting for me to observe that, you know, at the beginning of my career, most elderly or disabled were institutionalized. And fortunately, as the last years have gone by, we've increased independence and support for many of these folks to be at home. But this has also occurred at a time when families have become more mobile. And I found that these folks have become increasingly isolated, especially as our communities are less interactive as well. I mean, most of us don't even know who our neighbors are. And it was so amazing for me when I would pay my visits to experience their first need was touch. They would want to be held or hugged or hold my hand. And to be honest with you, a large part of my visit, sometimes as much as 75%, was social. And I embraced this, even though we're not supposed to. We're only supposed to spend so much time there. But I would literally get in, do my nursing, turn my computer off, and then sort of just socialize with them. And it was really significant to me. I would leave often wondering, how come we can't bridge this better? Or what can we do more about this? Because under Medicare, for example, you have to have a skilled need in order to even get the visit.
Right.
So I would have to facilitate that need first and then work with them socially. And I can tell you, my second home is Holland. And it's so very different in Holland. And I'm comparing apples and oranges, I get it. But on a human level, we know our neighbors there. And when somebody is not mobile or needs some intervention, everybody takes a part, whether you're the neighbor or a cousin or an auntie or just a friend. If something's going on in the village, you're picked up and you're brought down to the pub. If you just need to have a visit that day or, you know, go to the grocery store, you're picked up. And it's so very different. And I can tell you, these folks live really a long time, very happily and very engaged in their communities versus what I see here. We have such an isolated community that is so in need of time and touch. And I don't have the answer, but I can tell you from a nurse's heart, I can't even begin to describe how many people out there are by themselves.
All right, Lucy, thank you for that call. And that, I think, speaks exactly to what we're talking about today. And you said it really, really well. Dr. Argo, you have some thoughts on Lucy's call?
I was sitting here nodding and almost tearing up, actually, imagining you on those visits. Lucy, thank you so much for bringing this theme to this conversation. I don't think it's apples and oranges. I think the universal question of how we handle and hold aging as a society, how do we get older and still be our best selves and remain connected? Countries do this very differently. I once worked in Africa where, you know, elders were the most respected and revered and the heart of decision-making. I don't know that it's fair to say apples and oranges, right? We have completely different systems. It's not that we can take a system and just implement it here, but we can look, as you just described for us, and say that elders thrive in other settings. And one of the things that we've been thinking about a lot at Over Zero is how belonging and resilience go together for individuals, like you just described, right? So you described a community of connection. People who are in touch with one another, family, friends, neighbors, to say, oh, you know, this person has a need, a community that's attuned to the different challenges going on. And those communities and studies around the world are better at responding to environmental disaster or economic collapse or political violence, right? So this sense of belonging and being in it, right, together, is something that leads to better health outcomes for individual elders, but also for the community as a whole. And I think the task of figuring out how do we do that better here in our communities and as a nation, it's almost urgent, as you say.
And I think Lucy brought up a really great point when she talked about the fracturing of families and our mobile society and how many of us are living hundreds, thousands of miles away from the extended family, which, you know, 100 years ago, 50 years ago, was people didn't move as far. They didn't migrate to other areas. And so you had that natural sort of family built in. Now, a lot of folks in Alaska are from other places. There's either people that have been here forever and they have huge communities, or there's a lot of people who've come up for adventure and they've had to sort of build their own communities. And I think that's what Lucy was speaking to, is the importance of looking out for each other, essentially. All right. I have an email that I want to read that speaks to this also. It says, "Hi, I believe this need to feel respected and in control, belonging, is what is exploited by marketers, social media companies who promise to fill that need, but instead generate more need and more consumption. I think that arts and culture and good teaching, which are built on a relationship of trust, as in the Google study you cited, could be what has helped us survive all these millennia. How could arts, culture, and good teaching help us now? And what have you seen that works? The other question is, in trying to support more belonging by other people to help other people feel control over their lives, how does one group support empowerment by other people without taking away their agency?"
Those are two huge questions.
They are huge, and we don't have a lot of time, but go ahead.
All right. So, to the first question, I often think of community level. What do we do at the community level for belonging, right? And one of our findings in the barometer, we found that belonging scores were associated in America not just with general and mental health, but also with the experience of pain, how often people need to take medication for pain, for stress. And this was when we controlled for loneliness. So this told us that this concept of belonging actually holds value beyond social connection, right? But some of the other things we found was an increased desire to get to know others across difference, a buffered feeling of safety amidst change, whether that be demographic change or technological change, but this sense that that it's okay, I'm going to be okay. We found higher degrees of trust and social cohesion, more satisfaction with the United States and its democracy, and belief that we could improve that, so more agency. We found belonging was related to all of these things. And one of the takeaways, in the last 70 years, investments in civic infrastructure have completely depleted in our country. So a long time ago, in the middle of the last century, corporations and the United States government, they were funding local engagement and infrastructure at a different level. And today we don't have that, not in a sustained systematic way. But some of the things that we can do, just bringing people together for civic functions, for art and culture, for music, investing in the spaces and processes that allow us to connect, right? Across difference and create those relationships where then people say, "Oh, where's Sally today? Does Sally need something? How can I help?" This is something that used to be invested in, and we don't have that investment now. So just recognizing that and then asking at our neighborhood and community levels, okay, where do we fill that gap? How do we do that? I think that's one answer.
Yeah, there's a lot of answers that we could get into, but I do think of smaller rural towns that, like my grandparents growing up, there was so much connection and helping out. And when somebody's cows got up, the community rallied to come. And, so it seems like belonging is about safety. All right. So you got about 30 seconds. Give us some take home points or take home thoughts on belonging.
I guess I'll try to be motivational. I think in our study, we found that everybody has a role to play, that we set the stage, the moment we say hi to someone, we can be welcoming and inclusive. We can bring our full self, our authentic self to interactions. We should be aware that relationships across difference are the best thing we can do for our own personal friendship belonging. The more relationships across difference, the more belonging you have, and the better off your community.
All right. Thank you so much to you, Nicole Argo, for joining us today. It was a pleasure. My thanks to Line One producer Madeline Rose and audio engineer Chris Hyde. Until next time, I'm Prentice Pemberton. Have a great day, Alaska.
Line One is a production of Alaska Public Media, which is solely responsible for its content. Views expressed are those of the host and participants and not necessarily those of Alaska Public Media, this station, or its underwriters. Learn more about Line One and listen online at alaskapublic.org. This is Alaska Public Media.